It's a Friday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On today's episode, Patrick Cotter reports on NASA groundwater research in the Central Valley using satellite imagery. And Taylor Charlstrom will have a report about automated versus mechanical cultivators for weeding in processing tomatoes. And I'll be along with national and regional agricultural news. And we start with regional ag news right after this word from our sponsor.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
In regional agricultural news, from the U.S. Department of Agriculture National Agricultural Statistics Service's Pacific Region Non-Citrus Fruit and Nut Report for California from 2019 to 2021, almonds in terms of pounds and bearing acreage in 2019 were at 1,180,000, in 2020 they were at 1,250,000, and in 2021, 1,320,000. Yield per acre on an in-shell basis, in 2019 almonds were at 2,170, in 2020, 2,490, and in 2021, 2,210. Pistachios, again in terms of pounds and bearing acreage for 2019, they were at 340,000. In 2020, pistachios were at 372,000 and increased to 409,000 in 2021. Yield per acre in shell basis here as well. Pistachios were at 2,180 in 2019, 2,810 in 2020, and 2,820 in 2021. For walnuts, in terms of tons and bearing acreage in 2019, they were at 365,000 acres, in 2020, 380,000 acres, and in 2021, 390,000 acres. In shell basis, yield per acre for walnuts in 2019 were at 1.79, in 2020, 2.08, and in 2020, 1.86. Robo Research has released a report on the avocado market that estimates that shipping point prices will decline gradually now that Cinco de Mayo buying has finished. The holiday is the second largest driver of avocado consumption in the U.S. Nevertheless, they estimate that from mid-May to mid-summer, prices will remain higher on average than in 2020 and 2021, according to lead author David Magana, fresh produce analyst with Rabobank AgriFinance, the part of the global Rabobank group that serves U.S. agricultural producers. Starting from late summer, prices are likely to decline below the prices observed in 2021, but remain higher than those of 2020. The report says the second half of 2022 should see increased volume from Mexico, and volume from South America should also increase. This summer, California is expected to harvest higher volume than last year. Shipments from Peru to the U.S. will also likely rise, considering the disruptions in Europe with the conflicts. The report gives historical perspective showing how availability has risen in the U.S. from 1 billion pounds in 2005 to 2006 to 3 billion in 2020 to 2021, and per capita consumption has grown to more than 9 pounds, more than three times that in Europe, which has changed the strategies of supplying nations. Table grape category leader Four Star Fruit Incorporated of the San Joaquin Valley expects strong volume to supply this year's Mexican table grape season. Each year, Four Star Fruit boasts year-over-year volume growth. This year, the company is expecting their volume to grow between 25% to 30% due to their robust Mexican grape program. Harvest has begun this week and volume will continue to ramp up as the summer months progress, projecting good yield and great quality into late summer. The growers have committed to replanting the best industry varieties, according to Jack Campbell, longtime table grape grower, marketer, and shipper. He says they will be able to support strong retail promotions, in particular Memorial Day ads, with the volumes that they are projecting this season. The Mexican program allows Four Star Fruit to offer a well-rounded yearly supply of table grapes. Campbell says the commitment is to provide the consumer a best-in-class fresh grape experience, and retail partners see great value in their ability to manage that end-to-end. The International Fresh Produce Association is hosting the Food Service Conference July 28th and 29th in Monterey, California. It is the opportunity to connect with 1,700-plus attendees from across the supply chain, gather insights, spark dialogue, and experience innovations at the premier event dedicated specifically to fresh produce in service. People who should attend include operators, distributors, chefs and menu developers, K-12 representatives, and retail food service buyers, growers, shippers, and processors, and business solutions providers. And once again, the conference will be held July 28th and 29th at the Monterey Conference Center. For more information, call 302-607-2123. The first organic cherries and apricots from California were picked in late April and are now showing up in supermarkets around the country, proving summer is on its way. Stephen Paul, Stone Fruit Commodity Manager for Homegrown Organic Farms in Porterville, California, says they are nice size and present a nice pack. The apricot crop should last until mid-June, with Homegrown expecting good organic production of all of its stone fruits this season. Volume of fruit on the trees looks a bit lighter than last season, but he says there should be sufficient organic supplies to meet demand, including promotable volumes of all the stone fruit varieties as the season moves on. Right now, they have to focus on providing a customer a very good piece of fruit for their first experience of the year. He says they know if the first experience is good, they will come back again. And Paul Portray, General Manager of Sales and Marketing for Delta Packing in Lodi, California, noted that his firm's first cherries were picked in mid-April. By the end of the month, it was a seven-day-a-week operation with good volumes daily, though their total crop is expected to be much smaller than last year's record crop, which ended the season at 10.1 million cartons. This year, he says it's going to be around 50% of that, probably around 5 million cartons plus or minus 15%. The veteran cherry salesperson was speaking of the entire crop. Organic cherries, he says, represents only about 1% of California's production.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
You're listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Patrick Cotter in with a special report now on NASA groundwater research in the Central Valley.
NASA has released new research using a pair of science satellites to create a model of subsistence, or how the Earth sags after groundwater is pumped. Kyra Kim is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Jet Propulsion Lab.
So in the Central Valley, there's a lot of agricultural activity, as well as a lot of these mega cities that we're supporting. And so because of that, we have high uses of groundwater. So groundwater is easy to think about in terms of like a savings account. So surface water, you could think of it like checking account. Surface water would be things like rivers and lakes that's open to the surface. So it's actually very easy for us to measure how much there is. And it's also, you know, in times of drought, it's easy to see that it's missing as well. But for groundwater, it's a whole different ballgame because you need to drill a lot of wells to understand how much we have. And so it becomes a little bit of a tricky thing to study. In California, because it's supporting so much agricultural activity, you know, on top of all of these droughts and increasing population, groundwater has become kind of a critical resource. And in Central Valley, we're supporting about 50% of the nation's produce. So you can think of it as truly like a breadbasket of the nation. When we're extracting groundwater, it comes at a cost because it's suspending these sediments underneath our feet. When you extract groundwater, you actually end up collapsing that structure. And that's going to compact the aquifer at depth. The aquifer is just a geologic body that holds water. And that's going to manifest on the surface as land subsidence. Subsidence is responsible for some of the damage to civil infrastructure like roads, canals, bridges, things like that. And at the same time, we're actually decreasing the amount of water that the overall aquifer can hold. So it's a problem on two different fronts.
Understanding when and where subsistence will occur has always been difficult, but more sustainable pumping practices could be developed if an accurate model of groundwater deposits could be discovered.
So I think what really is exciting in this time is that we're able to get these big, large scale pictures, like I just mentioned. And because of that, we're able to understand how groundwater extraction can influence other processes like land subsidence. So in California, we have the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act that Governor Jerry Brown put in place. And basically, it's asking this these groundwater sustainability agencies all across Central Valley to make sure that we're using groundwater in a sustainable fashion, that we're avoiding this drastic subsidence in this region. So our model, I think, or our work is, you know, in line with a lot of the other researchers that are working on this problem. How do we better monitor? Because you can't really come up with a sustainable plan unless you know what the status quo is, like what's happening right now. What is groundwater doing? How drastic and how fast is subsidence in certain regions? And how are they related in time and space? Those things are going to be important as we start to move forward in sustainable management of groundwater. So I will say that while our work isn't quite ready to be, you know, used hands-on yet by some of our stakeholders that we're working with, it is an important step towards that direction.
Using data from two different satellite systems, Kim was able to accurately model how the groundwater was moving below the surface of the Earth and why subsistence sometimes seemed paradoxical.
So we used two different satellites to understand the relationship between groundwater depletion and land subsidence. The tricky thing about studying this is that the relationship is nonlinear, meaning, you know, in time and space, it's going to be different. You could draw groundwater from one place and you cannot see any subsidence versus in other places that have a lot of clays and fine sediments, you're going to see lagged subsidence or pretty drastic subsidence. We use a satellite called GRACE for the groundwater depletion problem, and that's a gravity-sensitive satellite. And so what it's actually doing is it's responding to the Earth's mass, and the more mass the Earth has is going to have a higher gravitational pull, and that's going to accelerate and decelerate the satellite. That's how we get the overall picture of groundwater, which I think is brilliant. It's been going on since around 2003. And then we use this other satellite called Sentinel-1. It's a radar-based measurement. And what it's doing is it's flying over and then it's basically measuring, you know, what's the vertical up and down of the land motion at that location. We synthesize these together. And so we could try to understand, okay, for this much groundwater depletion, what's the land subsidence happening in this region? And what we did in this work that was recently highlighted was we created a model and said, let's pretend that the aquifer is two different layers of a cake. Like, think of it as a two-layer cake. It's actually more, you know, complex than that. But we simplified it into that. We were able to synthesize the two satellite data sets together. Think of it as a layer cake. And previously, you know, we said, oh, the geology is really complex in this region. So we need a lot of these details to understand the relationship between groundwater and subsidence. For the purposes of this work, we just simplified it and say, let's pretend that there's two layers and let's pretend that there's no vertical water flow. So meaning layer one, it does happen in certain parts where, you know, if you have some rainfall on the top layer, you'll start to see some increases in water in the deeper layer. But for the purposes of this work, we just said, okay, let's just say that they're connected in this volume change only, meaning if there's a lot of rain on the top layer, it becomes heavier, right? And so that will squish the lower layer. And so we said that is probably the dominant movement of land surface, where depending on the mass change of the upper layer, we're going to have changes in the deeper layer. And that is going to be measured by the Sentinel-1 product. And then we said the overall water change, however, in both of the layers will be, you know, monitored by GRACE. And so by using that relationship and just hypothesizing that this would work, we developed a model to connect the two data sets together. With this project in specific, we are hoping to expand to the entire Central Valley. So we only looked at a very drastically subsiding region in the Tulare Basin, but hopefully we could expand to the entire Central Valley to see how the model behaves and see, you know, if we could apply it to other regions. So that's the, you know, short term next step. We have an exciting launch called NISAR. This is the NASA ISRO collaborations. It's a different SAR product, similar to what we were using here in this work, the Sentinel-1 mission. So with the NISAR launch, we are hoping we'll be able to get data for other places as well and maybe expand to see how the model behaves in other regions that have this similar problem. But yeah, so far it's showing promising results.
For My Ag Life Daily News, I'm Patrick Cotter.
Unsure of your naval orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard at hull split from naval orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed, broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
A sharp fall in exports resulting from the Russian invasion is causing a significant shortage of storage facilities in Ukraine for the 2022 to 2023 season. Analyst APK Inform says the Ukraine is getting forced to export grain by train over its western border or from smaller ports along the Danube River. APK Inform says that Ukraine's exports may total just 45.5 million tons of the 2021 record harvest total of 86 million tons. And Reuters News says grain and oilseed stocks at the end of the current season may reach an all-time high of 21.3 million tons. That volume is 4.2 times higher than the previous season, but there's not enough storage capacity for any new harvest that comes in. Ukraine is typically a major grain and oilseed grower for the world, but exports have dropped sharply. Ukraine exported 763,000 tons in April compared to 2.8 million tons at the same time last year. The National Association of Conservation Districts was pleased to hear that USDA accepted offers of more than 2 million acres in Conservation Reserve Program enrollment. They are applauding USDA and commending them for their leadership in continuing to administer this critical program, according to NACD President Michael Crowder. He says CRP is a voluntary program and a significant component to conservation that over the years has played a key role in restoring the environment and ensuring the sustainability of agricultural lands. The organization says CRP is a critical tool in USDA's conservation program efforts. NACD is pleased that more than 2 million acres have been accepted through CRP and looks forward to USDA continuing its excellent stewardship of this program, according to NACD CEO Jeremy Peters. He says CRP plays a key component to conservation. They are excited to see enrollment options become available to as many eligible producers as possible, particularly those that manage vulnerable lands. Ag labor remains one of the chief concerns for the farming community, not only due to increase in cost, but also limited availability. Dan Newhouse, chair of the Western Caucus, says, unfortunately, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which has already cleared the House, is stalled in the Senate. He says they continue to work with counterparts in the Senate to elevate the level of urgency to encourage action.
There's, I think, growing amount of support for doing something. People recognize the urgency in our agricultural industry for labor in most parts of the country, not all. We're just not at that sweet spot yet where we can get a bill to the floor of the Senate.
Newhouse stressed the Farm Workforce Modernization Act looks to reform the H-2A program, which he says would address many issues the farming community is facing when it comes to the U.S.-Mexico border.
We've had a very hard time with the Department of Labor allowing H-2A workers who have visas working through the Department of Homeland Security to be able to come in, go to work, and get vaccinated at the responsibility of their employer. They will not allow us to do that, as they did last year. They allowed that program to happen last year, which is very frustrating.
Newhouse points out the vaccination process last year was very successful and should be used again this year. He added farm workers are critical and are needed to produce the food and fiber that Americans and the world needs and expects. The president Wednesday announced a fall time conference focusing on ways to end hunger and improve nutrition and health by the year 2030. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
This September, I'll be convening a White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health.
President Joe Biden with the announcement on Wednesday. The conference is designed to catalyze both the public and private sectors.
Anti-hunger and nutrition advocates, food companies, local and state governments, tribal and territory communities to lay out our plan to combat hunger and improve nutrition for every American.
A whole-of-government approach designed to accelerate progress in areas ranging from improved nutrition to closing disparity gaps by the year 2030. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, in a statement Wednesday, acknowledges USDA's partnering in efforts to end hunger and increase healthy eating in America by 2030. Information about and ways to solicit ideas for the conference is available online.
Go to whitehouse.gov/hungerhealthconference.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Pressure to reverse the impact on carbon dioxide continues to make headlines. Farm News reporter Michael Clements has more.
A new survey from Agoro Carbon Alliance reveals consumer insights on carbon farming and the important role of farmers and ranchers. Caleb Smith, Agoro Carbon Agronomist, shares more.
What this survey really found was that most of the general public is not aware of carbon farming or carbon markets. About 77% of people were actually not aware of carbon farming. Another thing that it found was that over one half of respondents aged 25 to 34 and one half of respondents in urban areas feel really strongly that any farmer who's participated in a carbon reduction program is seen as a leader in the fight against climate change. And this is really important because as we have less and less people connected to the farm, we have less people who understand modern farming. So the more young people and the more people in urban areas that see farming as a solution to the climate crisis, the better.
While the survey shows consumers didn't necessarily know the positive role farmers and ranchers could play in the carbon market, they considered farmers leaders after learning more.
Most consumers don't feel that farmers and ranchers have as much a responsibility to fight climate change as other sectors. And a lot of that's because agriculture only accounts for about 10% of our emissions in the U.S. annually. Consumers don't feel that farmers and ranchers are part of the problem. They really see them as part of the solution. And that's ultimately what we can take away from this.
Smith says Agoro Carbon was eager to have a better understanding of how consumers felt about agriculture in the carbon space.
What we really wanted to learn was how consumers felt about carbon farming. And we wanted to learn how consumers would change their behavior in accordance with how farmers are changing their behaviors. Really, what we found is that consumers are willing to change the way that they buy products. They're willing to pay a premium for these low carbon products. Ultimately, what we found is that most of the general public is not super aware of carbon farming, but those that are feel really strongly that farmers that participate in carbon reduction programs are leaders in the fight against climate change.
According to Smith, carbon farming is critical to the future of agriculture.
When we think about over the last 70 or so years, one of the things we think about is this big yield increase that's happened. And we like to think that this big yield increase is solely the result of better genetics and better management. But some really recent research has found that the climate actually has a lot more to do with increases in yield in the Corn Belt than anything else. As our growing seasons are getting longer, we have more growing degree days. The issue is that it's not going to stop getting warmer. It's going to continue to get warmer, and it's going to become really difficult to produce these crops. So essentially anything we can do to improve the chance that farms are still here in 100 years, we should be doing it. Ultimately, what matters most to us is that our growers are able to farm this land and pass it on to the generations to come.
Agoro Carbon has a variety of resources to learn more about carbon farming and markets.
One of the things you can do is go to agorocarbonalliance.com to learn more. We have a great knowledge hub with articles from myself and other folks from our team around all things carbon markets. We have articles on the science of carbon sequestration, some of the economics behind carbon markets and where the money comes from and how it gets moved around. And anything you want to know about carbon markets can be found at our website.
To find these resources and more, visit agorocarbonalliance.com. That's A-G-O-R-O carbonalliance.com. Michael Clements reporting.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
Taylor Chalstrom joins us now here on the My Ag Life Daily News Report with information on automated versus mechanical cultivators for weeding in processing tomatoes.
Conventional processing tomato weed management in California often includes pre-plant herbicides followed by cultivation and hand hoeing. Rimsulfuron herbicide can also be used in conventional systems and can be applied either pre- or post-transplanting. Post-transplant applications of Rimsil Furon can selectively remove nightshades if applied when the weeds are very young, no more than 2 tree leaves. However, long plant-back restrictions may limit its use. Therefore, the use of hand crews is often needed to remove weeds that emerge in the plant row where standard cultivation equipment is effective. In an effort to reduce the use of these pre-plant herbicides and move to new forms of cultivation, robotic cultivators and finger weeders are being used and evaluated in many vegetable crops, including processing tomatoes. Adoption is looking good, but there are some pros and cons to each.
The finger weeder can be easily adjusted and to fit individual farmer needs and is much cheaper than an automated weeder. I don't believe there's many automated weeders that are commercially available. They're still really trying to get that technology into kind of a California system, and they're constantly improving. The finger weeder can also move faster through a field than an automated weeder could because it's a mechanical implement. The automated weeder precision and technology is continuously being updated and improved. And in the right conditions, they work very, very well, but they are expensive. And both weeders require the right timing for ideal weed control. You don't want the crop to be too big, but you also want the young weeds to have already emerged.
That was Amber Venkese-Vall, a UCCE Vegetable Crops Advisor for Colusa, Sutter, and Yuba counties. She said that the introduction of automatic and mechanical cultivators is supposed to complement or even potentially replace a traditional herbicide program. However, there has been little research to evaluate this possibility.
Most conventional processing tomato growers apply herbicides pre-plant and then incorporate them into the soil. Some growers will also do a post-transplant application of Rimsil Furon to help with nightshade control. This is done about 2 weeks after transplanting. And this is about the time you'd run those in-row cultivators, about 2 to 4 weeks after transplanting. So depending on the field conditions, you could do 2 weeks or you could do 4 weeks. I don't know that these cultivators could actually replace an herbicide program for conventional growers, but they do work well to complement those pre-plant incorporated herbicides and could potentially replace that post-transplant application. But it depends on grower preference, field conditions, and your weed pressure, of course. And we did find in our research that windy conditions do affect the efficacy of both types of cultivators.
The main objective of Venkese-Vall's project was to evaluate crop safety, weed control, time, and costs associated with using mechanical cultivators as part of a conventional weed management program in processing tomatoes. In general, the automated and mechanical cultivators performed well in the trials.
We found that the finger weeder provided excellent control, over 95% actually, in 2020 in both Merced and Colusa, except for there was one plot in Colusa that had heavy bindweed pressure, and these in-row cultivators aren't very good at getting rid of bindweed. And then we had moderate control with the finger weeder in Colusa in 2021. We also had pretty great weed control in Colusa with the Robovator in 2020. But unfortunately, in Merced in 2020 and Colusa in 2021, high winds created non-upright tomato plants. So they were kind of flopped over, and this affected the precision accuracy of the Robovator. We had a lot of technical difficulties, and we've learned that these windy conditions are really not ideal for the Robovator and even the moderate control we had with the finger weeder. And we had up to 30% crop injury in certain areas of the field in Merced in 2020, and then 11 to 19% crop injury in Colusa in 2021. Though I will note that despite that crop injury, there was no effect on yield. We still had pretty good yields with the Robovator. And then one of the biggest takeaways is that the hand weeding time and costs were significantly reduced using Rimsil Furon, finger weeder, or the Robovator compared to the control that had no in-row cultivation.
With the results of the project being that the finger weeder provided more consistent control of weeds in processing tomatoes and is more economically feasible than the Robovator, Venkese-Vall recommended the finger weeder to growers as a cultivating option.
It can be used in lots of different crops. It's much more economical, and also it's an implement. So once you buy it, you have it, and it's always going to kind of work the same way. There's not going to be these constant updates. Automated weeding is amazing, and it's really cool to see the demonstrations and kind of where that market is going. And I know vegetable crop producers in California are very excited about kind of that as a future option.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.